Hello and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do Chapter 13 of George Lincoln Rockwell's White Power, written and published back in the late 60s, shortly before he was assassinated. Chapter 13 begins, titled White Imperia. White Power, Book, Chapter 13, White Imperium. White Roman Empire, think of that. In the previous chapter, I have presented the almost unbelievable evidence that, faced with the ultimate catastrophe in all human history, the only response of most of our side has been to follow the enemy. Before I proceed with a presentation of what can and must be done to stop this suicidal insanity, I must pause to reinforce in the mind of the reader that this struggle is not only for keeps, but that the loss of the struggle will mean slaughter and terror such as this planet has never before experienced. The Jews and their colored allies, behind the hell in the world today, are not fooling. They do not use half measures. They kill their enemies. For an unimpeachable witness to the bloody, murderous nature of the Jews, one only has to inspect their own words. They boast about it. In the early centuries of human history, all races and groups did plenty of killing, but only the Jews and other Orientals have ever wallowed in the blood and gloried in the agony and bizarre slaughter of their victims with a depraved hate. If this sounds too extreme, pick up the Jewish Torah, the Old Testament, and read the first few chapters as history. The men whom the Jews worship as their saints and prophets were the bloodiest gang of massacre artists in all history by their own testimony. Everywhere they went, they delighted in slaughtering all those who, quote, pisseth against the wall, as they like to put it, sometimes going still further and murdering even the pigs, cattle, cats, and dogs of their enemies. Amalek, as it were. And there's lots of verses in the Old Testament talking about doing just that, going in and slaughtering the men, women, and children, but also the animals, the livestock, the pets, and anything associated with the evil enemy. Edward Gibbon provides another historical example. He's the famous historian who wrote a multi-volume, I think it's 17-volume, history of the decline of Rome. Edward Gibbon provides another historical example of the Oriental Jewish propensity for murder in his monumental and authoritative Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. On page 384 of edition published in London in 1783, Gibbon writes, quote, "From the reign of Nero to that of Antoninus Pius, the Jews displayed a fierce impatience of the dominion of Rome, which repeatedly broke out in the most furious massacres and insurrections. Humanity is shocked at the recital of the horrid cruelties that they, the Jews, committed in the cities of Egypt, of Cyprus, and of Cyrene, where they dwelt in treacherous friendship with the unsuspecting natives. In Cyrene, they massacred 220,000 Greeks. In Cyprus, 240,000. In Egypt, a very great multitude. Many of these unhappy victims were sawed asunder according to a precept to which David had given the sanction of his example. The victorious Jews devoured the flesh, licked up the blood, and twisted the entrails like a girdle around their bodies." Too few Americans are aware of the fact that in modern times, the most frightful gangs of killers ever spawned in America is not the mafia, but a gang of Jews from the Lower East Side of New York City. Murder, Inc. was based in the Greenpoint District of Brooklyn, Greenpoint, and run by Jews, Louis Lepke Buchalter. In the tradition of the Torah, Jews and the Jews mentioned by Gibbon, who sawed people asunder and danced in the streets wearing the entrails of their victims, the bloodthirsty Jews of Murder, Inc. specialized in trussing up their victims alive and then stabbing them to death slowly with ice picks for cash. No other group of killers for pay has ever equaled the bloody Jewish Murder, Inc. from a hard-to-find book called Murder, Inc. about the cleanup of this gang by the former Attorney General of New York, Thomas E. Dewey, the one that ran for president, I copied down the choice characters as they appeared in the book. Take a look at the names of the people involved in this Jewish murder mill for money. Now comes a decent list. Al Glass, Carl Shapiro, Max the Jerk Golob, Irving Chippy Wiener, Abadabba Berman, Waxy Gordon Wexler, Bo Weinberg, Emmanuel Mendy Weiss, Tootsie Feinstein, Shalom Bernstein, Hyman Kasner, Jacob Hooky Rossman. Notice how many of them have nicknames, similar to the Italians. Mickey Cohen, you've heard of him. Charlie Workman, Mert Wertheimer, Pittsburgh Phil Strauss, Pretty Amberg, this Abe Wagner Jew specialized in murder, Bugsy Goldstein by torture with an ice pick, Bugsy Siegel, another one you've heard of, the Jew that founded Vegas, as they like to say, Dopey Benny Fine, Benny the Boss Tannenbaum, Abraham Misfit Landau, Big Harry Schachter. Again, these are the Jews you find, sort of name you find throughout communism, whether they're German communist or Russian communist. Most of these are German, but some are Jew. Some are Russian Jew. Big Harry Schachter, Meyer Lansky, Joey Amberg, Ganji Cohen, Emmanuel Manny Kessler, Puggy Fettenstein, Dandy Phil Castell, Frankie Teitelbaum, Longie Zwillman, Lulu Rosenkrantz, Isidore Curley Holtz, Charlie Solomon, Paul Berger. Again, these are normal German names. Holtz, Berger, Kessler. Remember David Kessler, the awful head of medical stuff, like an earlier forerunner of Fauci and his dishonesty and attempt to agglomerate all and centralize all power under Jew federal authority. Lou Cohen, Wolfie Goldis, Abe Slabow, Nig Rosen, Yasha Katzenberg, Fat Sidney Blatz, Max Rubin, Ali TikTok Tannenbaum, Charlie Yanowski, Moses Moe Dimples Wolinski, Max Shaman, Happy Meltzer, Moses Moe Sedway, Al Silverman, Harry Big Greeny Lou Glasser, Greenbaum, Willie Shapiro, Jacob Gura Shapiro, Max Blecker, Sam Gasper, Harry Millman, Arnold Rothstein, Muddy Kessoff, Joey Silvers, Hyman Uren, Y-U-R-A-N, Fatty Koperman, Solomon Jack Goldstein, Izzy Fardestein, and many others. All Jews, that's Murder, Inc. There's a fair sampling of who they are, what they were named, their nicknames. During World War II, the Nazis were supposed to have been the ultimate in brutality and ruthlessness, but the fact is that they failed precisely because they were not as ruthless and brutal as the enemy. Should pause and note we're on page 234 of 272. This is a shorter chapter, about 15 pages. Last chapter 12 was the longest of the current bunch of segments, and the rest will be in maybe two more recordings. A couple of them are much smaller chapters. But anyway, so you're getting the point. Jews have in their own words, as they describe themselves, they're vicious, bloodthirsty murderers. They're fake friends who live among others, feed off them, smile to their face, and stab them in the back, cut them in half, dance around wearing their entrails. That's their history. That's what they put in their own so-called religious book. And the Me Too Jews, the Jew wannabes, the Christians, are people who have been captured mentally by this people and formed into a slave cult, worshiping one of these nasty murdering types as God. How absurd is that? There's nothing more absurd in all human history than Aryans worshiping a Jew. Almost all the guerrilla fighters behind Nazi lines have since turned out to be communists and Jews. When these communist partisans started shooting German soldiers in the back from ambush during World War II, and murdering troops and civilians by blowing up trains, the Germans responded by shooting some hostages, but almost always with a certain restraint. The inevitable result was always a more bitter resistance by the Reds, because when you strike a blow at a determined enemy, it must smash him completely, or it only fires him up to greater resistance, hatred, and strength. When you use terror, as the Jews know all too well, it must be total. The Jews are a race that is all or nothing. They bet it all on being able to dominate all other people, but the only people they really need to dominate are whites. That's not to say they don't try to dominate all other people. I just saw an example of the ADL and their anti-white obnoxious A World of Difference, that ideological program they've laid out to mess up whites in schools promoting diversity. They sent a whole team over, and they're working with the Japanese to mess up Japan as an example of a non-white people they'd like to mess up because they maintain their racial integrity. So they work on the dual front of trying to get them to open their border to, say, Filipino or other invasive African migrant so-called workers for under the economic pretext. But they also work on getting a beachhead for their anti-racial ideology that promotes and protects Jews as a protected racial class while devaluing everyone else and turning anyone who would protect himself into an evil racist. Word they coined specifically to prevent the mindset and the ideas pertaining to racial self-awareness, self-valuing, and self-protection from ever even forming in the youth of any racial enemy, even whether it's a Japanese, let alone a white. This is how Jews act. They work in your mind and they work in your body. They chop you up and they feed you lies. When you use terror, as the Jews know all too well, it must be total. So they are all or nothing. We have to make sure that it's nothing. And that means we exterminate them, and it's a counter-extermination because they started it. Observe what these communist lovers of humanity did in the Katyn Forest in Poland during World War II. The U.S. Senate investigated this unspeakable atrocity. Essentially, they decapitated Poland. They took 10 to 15,000 of their top people, their top military people, their top intellectuals, top business people, top whatever in any field, and they just chopped their heads off, shot them, buried them in a pit, blamed Nazis. The U.S. Senate investigated this unspeakable atrocity, and you can check the facts in the U.S. Senate report of the massacres there. As soon as the communists overran Poland, the Jew commissar in the Red Army gathered all the officers of the Polish army, not just the top ones, but every officer in the Polish army, 15,000 of them, marched them out into the Katyn Forest and systematically slaughtered them. They buried these 15,000 Polish officers in acres of mass graves. When the Germans got control of eastern Poland, they found the mass graves. They called in the International Red Cross to inspect the site right after they found it, and then invited two top U.S. Army colonels to see, with their own eyes, this bloody evidence of the nature of the Jews who were leading our gallant Soviet allies, as I was being told at the time, like Roosevelt or one of his flunkies called them that, Uncle Joe. So the Germans said, look, they came across it to make sure that they weren't blamed, that it was documented, it wasn't them who did it, because they knew the Jews still, the brother of the Jew murderers who murdered the flower of the Polish people, their nobility, they knew that the brothers of those people controlled the press in the West and would lie about it and blame it on the Germans. And that's what they did quite successfully for quite a long time. So the Germans brought in the International Red Cross. They brought in a couple American colonels. Roosevelt and his gang gagged these two U.S. officers and threatened them with court-martial if they ever opened their mouths. They didn't want the American people to know that they were fighting on the side of these brutal, vicious, communist Jew killers. My point in picking out this tiny bit of evidence of the nature of the monsters we fight is to show you a pattern of systematic extermination that will quickly destroy us, our people, and our whole civilization unless we stop it. With an exclamation point. The Jewish masters of world revolution never take any chances on attacks behind their lines. They know that most people don't move without leadership of the elite of their group, the natural leaders, just as your hands won't move without the leadership of your head. So the Jewish revolution is systematically, coldly, smash the head. That is why they killed all the Polish officers, not a few hostages, as the Germans might have done, the whole leadership corps of Polish strength. Beheaded, the Polish people never again caused the Reds any real trouble. One of the latest refinements in the Jewish technique of beheading whole peoples and movements is used more and more frequently in the Soviet satellite states of Europe, which were given to the Reds by traitors in the U.S. government. The wily Jews running things from behind the scenes in these unhappy Soviet work colonies have discovered and put to use an absolutely devilish scheme to keep any resistance to Jewish tyranny from ever succeeding. From time to time, these calculating communist friends, just like their brethren in Murder, Inc., cold-bloodedly plot, organize, and pull off a rebellion against themselves. Secretly, they permit the arming and organizing of a resistance they themselves have promoted. They watch it develop, sometimes helping if it seems to falter. Their, quote, radio-free Europe, unquote, has this devilish purpose, for example. This would be a Jew version of let a thousand flowers bloom. And the point of letting them bloom is to pluck them. As soon as they feel sure it has rounded up all the best and most daring potential leaders of the people, they precipitate open rebellion, which lets them swoop in and exterminate the latest and newest crop of leaders, which is what they were after in the first place. This actually happened in Hungary in 1956. This calculating deviltry has the added advantage that the tortured people begin to be aware of how they have been suckered, so that any future leaders who try to organize any resistance are instantly treated as enemy agents provocateurs by their own peoples, no matter how sincere. See how they talk about like Patriot Front today or some other group that might be the real thing. They believe everyone who is fit, active, organized is a Fed, which means a Jew. It is impossible for resistance to develop in such a fog of suspicion. In recent centuries, the Jews have found an even easier way to kill off the hated Goyim. They get us to do it. My brother used to be the bouncer in a roughneck dance hall. Since my brother is anything but a tough guy, I asked him how he survived as a sort of cop among all those brutal hoods. He answered, whenever I find a tough who is a drunk and causing trouble, I go find a bigger tough, usually just as drunk, and tell him I need his help. I build up his ego, make him feel important, and convince him that the other guy is an enemy. He goes over and throws the other guy out, and then I lock them both out. For at least 100 years now, the Jews have been working this diabolical scheme on white nations the world over. Whenever I travel from our Arlington, Virginia headquarters to our printing and production plant down in the Virginia countryside between Washington and Richmond, I pass through some of the most blood-soaked ground in America, battlegrounds of a war in which more white Americans were slaughtered than all the rest of our wars combined. People forget that the so-called Civil War was our greatest bloodletting, far surpassing World Wars I and II and all our other wars. Sometimes when I see one of the little historical markers on the highway, I stop the car and walk out into the quiet hills and meadows where armies of brave young Americans killed each other. As I stand there on the long, silent battlefields of Bull Run, Manassas, Fredericksburg, Spotsylvania, or Chancellorsville, surrounding the national headquarters and printing plant of the American Nazi Party, I can almost hear the bugles and shouts of those hundreds of thousands of the finest youths on both sides, the rebel yells stopped suddenly by a thrust of cold steel in the gut and changed to a scream of terror and death. I can hear the animal grunts as my brothers on both sides work hard at the bloody job of stabbing, shooting, cannonading, and clubbing their own brothers to death by the hundreds of thousands, all on behalf of swarms of half-ape Negroes who are now tearing up America. I'm not ashamed to admit that standing there in the peaceful silence of the countryside and visualizing thousands of our heroic young lads killing and dismembering each other on those battlefields, I cannot hold back the tears. The so-called Civil War is far enough back in history today so that many Americans on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line can begin to see, at last, the tragic folly of this fratricide. For many years now, as I write this, the Southern Democrats and the conservative Republicans of the North have been standing together, at least in some congressional struggles, to try to repair some of the crazy damage done to our white race on the bloody battlefields of the Civil War. The Civil War was not fought to preserve the Union, as the propaganda goes, but to serve the commercial interests of the racial agitators who provoked that war with their Uncle Tom's Cabin propaganda and their sob sister hypocritical love of the blacks. These same racial agitators happily and greedily brought their colored friends over to America by the boatload when it paid, up until 1808 when the slave trade was stopped. But as soon as the Southern commercial competition seemed inconvenient to them, as soon as there was no more cash in selling the blacks, then their hearts went out to the poor persecuted half-apes that they had so recently delivered in chains from Africa for gold, for cash, and the great sailing ships of the North. We know that the slave trade was dominated by Jews, North and South. Plantation economy, too. To some I didn't know, read the NOI book number 2. They got a series of 3. The Civil War was only the first of the wars of racial suicide, quote-unquote, of our people, the first of the 100-year marathon of mutual slaughter of white brother by white brother, and now that air bombing is possible, the slaughter of white sisters, too, by white brothers, as we did during World War II when we slaughtered 250,000 of them fleeing from communism in the beautiful, non-military, defenseless city of Dresden. Nothing is so completely insane and suicidal as the eager rush of white men all over the world to murder each other by the millions whenever it suits the Jews and their lying liberal friends to set us at each other's throats. The Jews have only to use their newspapers, television, radio, books, magazines, and school texts to poison our minds, and different groups of white men can be fired up to murderous rage against each other time after time. Socially sanctioned killing, socially approved killing. Killing you can't get fired or canceled for. You can die, but what's that compared to being canceled? The Jews have only to tell us of the atrocities committed by some other group of white men, and we slaughter them by the millions. Always it is the best manhood among us that is killed off in these fratricidal wars, since the less able are left at home as 4Fs, while the best potential fathers go off to the slaughter. And of these best who do go to the slaughter, it is always the cream of the crop of the best of our manhood who get killed first, since they are the ones whose idealism and courage lead them to be the volunteers in the first assaults and on especially dangerous missions. Whenever any segment of the white race appears to the Jews to be on the road to recovery of national health, and therefore ready to flush out the germs of Jewish degeneracy and disease, the Jews simply go to work on all the rest of the white world, exactly as predicted in the protocols, to inflame the rest of us against our own brothers. They lie to us that our white brothers are the enemy, that our white brothers are torturing and murdering babies and innocent people, that they are planning to conquer us and enslave or murder us, that they are beasts, that all humanity cries out for us to go and smash our brothers, always on behalf of these Jews and or Negroes, and for the last half century, on behalf of the communists. What did the American majority get out of World War I or World War II? Did we save the world from tyranny? No. Did we make the world safe for democracy? No. Did we gain any land or great rich prizes, any mines or colonies? No. All we got were headaches, responsibilities, and more little spit-in-the-eye wars, anti-American hate, Berlin Walls, foreign aid handouts, Koreas, Vietnams, Cubas, and endless riots and crime at home. That is the standard pattern of our wars today, mutual suicide of white against white, followed by the handing over to communists, Jews, and Negroes of more and more of our territory, wealth, rights, and power, and the disarming of any real opposition to Jewish-led scum as a form of treason to the, quote, American dream. Zelensky parts, Jewish parts in the Callahan American Aryan box. American dream is what Jews say it is. Well, the people who don't think they can sell that lie. As long as the conservatives are too cowardly to face up to this fact, and continue to blast real anti-communist fighters such as the German National Socialists and now the American Nazis, we will be utterly defenseless against the wily Jews. You cannot claim the truth as your biggest weapon and then crawl at the feet of the Jews to tell the biggest lies of all time about Adolf Hitler and your own fighters. To see the psychological folly of a conservative position on Hitler and the Nazis, just imagine the effect if there had been large numbers of rich Mexicans living in the United States at the time of the Alamo. Further, let's suppose that most American newspapers were owned and controlled by Mexican Americans so that our people heard nothing else but that Davy Crockett and his gang of, quote, war criminals were committing, quote, aggressive war by seizing Mexican property at the Alamo, while Santa Anna led the democratic forces of justice and mercy. Any American who questioned the evilness of Davy Crockett or who doubted the goodness of Santa Anna would never get a hearing, but would be immediately dubbed a Mexican hater, an anti-Mexican, and then be driven into poverty and disgrace. Unless somebody had the guts and integrity to tell the truth about the heroism of Davy Crockett and his men at the Alamo, America itself would soon be completely in the hands of the Mexicans. That's what the Jews have accomplished by scaring or swindling American conservatives into joining the Jews in their Hate Hitler and anti-Nazi campaign of lies and filth. Without the inspiration and heroism of men like Crockett and Bowie and Travis, we can't win our wars. When you become so depraved and cowardly that you can be scared into cursing your own heroes, you have lost the power to survive. History has already marked you for the ash heap. Remember, this is after, I'm reading 2024, this is after seeing last few years all of our monuments of our Southern and our American heroes pulled down. The laughing scum Antifa backed by Jew newspapers publishing picture of the glowing remainder of the face of Robert E. Lee from a statue, even that level. In 1932, when the conspirators managed to get Franklin Roosevelt and his Jewish gang into the White House, they planned an open takeover for their communist revolution. Communist world revolution. America had been lied to, primed with a terrible depression, and sold the Roosevelt Bill of Goods, it would have been a cinch. But the monkey wrench in their machinery of world revolution was Germany, which was the key to the control of Europe. Unless Germany could be seized, or at least rendered powerless, as it now has been, world communist victory would be impossible. At the last moment, a strong man arose and seized the initiative from the scheming Jews. Adolf Hitler managed to win back sanity and honor so many millions of good German people that the weak government was forced to give Hitler legal power by the will of the people. Adolf Hitler fought the Alamo of the white race. That's a good thing to remember what he's saying. Adolf Hitler fought the Alamo of the white race. He held off the colored forces of racial suicide, the forces of communism, the forces of arrogant Zionism, and the forces of international money manipulation, long enough for a few men, like myself, to wipe the Jewish cobwebs out of our brains and start the long battle to awaken our people and free them from the menacing specter of Jewish and colored world tyranny. Hitler purchased, with his own life and the lives of millions of young German men, the precious time for us to be able to wake up and organize to resist the Jews and Negroes, just as Crockett and his men purchased, with their lives, the time for General Sam Houston to organize to resist the Mexicans. To get back to our Mexican-American analogy, can you imagine how the Mexicans would have been doubled up laughing in private if at the time of the Alamo, all American leaders were denouncing Crockett and his men as, quote, a gang of hoodlums, war criminals, bullies, Huns, operators of Mexican slaughter camps, etc., while at the same time these American leaders were heaping endless praise on their wonderful, patriotic Mexican, quote, friends here in America and sending every kind of help and aid to Santa Anna, calling him good old Uncle Santa, just as Truman referred to Stalin as good old Uncle Joe. But there's more to the conservative madness. Today the Jews have actually got the conservatives in America repeating in chorus like a bunch of parrots, communism and Nazism are the same thing. So that form of retardation we associate with boomers has a much longer history than we might think. It's a deliberate tactic, a deliberate lie that the people who fought the communists are the same thing as the communists. That's a lie promoted by the people who are actually the blood and ideological brothers of the real communists, the Jews. This allows conservatives to prove to the Jews and red terrorists that they, the conservatives, are just as anti-Nazi as they are communists, i.e. the real alternative. And they throw in the Catholics there with them. They often make that same bogus equation. This bit of madness must have the Jews rolling on the floor, holding their sides in agonies and paroxysms of laughter. To get the full flavor of this, communism and Nazism are the same thing, madness, I must ask the reader to bear with me a moment while we return to the Alamo analogy. Imagine, if you can, all the respectable men and patriots of the time, all doing lots of profitable business with Mexicans, swearing up and down to their Mexican friends that while they were pro-American, they were certainly not anti-Mexican. To equal the madness of the present-day patriots saying communism and Nazism are the same thing, these patriots of the Alamo days would have to be bowing up and down before their Mexican business partners like figures in Black Forest clocks, repeating over and over, "We're not anti-Mexican. In fact, we're just as much against Crockett as we are against Santa Anna. In fact, Crockett and Santa Anna are the same thing. They're both shooting and using guns." It's really as simple as that, although when you're right in the middle of it all and you yourself are subject to the terrorism and smear and loss of job and fortune arranged by the Jewish lovers of democracy, it may be hard for you to realize the full depth of this anti-Hitler madness for a while. In historical perspective, William Buckley, again, head of National Review, who he's talked about meeting and even working for, putting Max Lerner, Jacob Javits, one of the Jews who opened the borders, and a long parade of vile, pinko, red, and Zionist Jews on his TV program and treating them like noble and honest Americans while he cannot find enough words to curse and damn me or anybody else who dares to tell the truth about Adolf Hitler will be downright funny if we survive long enough to laugh. So Buckley was co-opted if he didn't start that way. Just another liberal rag, as Wilmore Kendall said about National Review in the late 60s. Buckley let Jewish money determine his editorial line. For 100 years, the Jewish agitators have doubled and redoubled the rate at which we are killing off our best by pitting brother against brother in endless silly wars we always lose and they always win. The Jew aim is and remains the wiping out of the best goyim, as the Talmud puts it. They keep getting us killed, now by the millions, while they increase and grow stronger. In the beginning of the chapter, I mentioned that there was one other Oriental group besides the Jews that has distinguished itself in history for the magnitude of its slaughter and bloodthirstiness, the Mongols. There is nothing else in all history to match the record of hideous mass cruelty and murder of the Golden Horde of Genghis Khan. The same Asiatic strain in the Jews that produces such a love of slaughter and cruelty is found in its pure, original form in the savage Mongol. When this yellow beast of Asia rises up and stalks the earth, the great writer of history dips his pen in blood and prepares to write chapters of death, suffering, and destruction. But that was hundreds of years ago. What could Genghis Khan have done with a hydrogen bomb today? Unless you, white man, can muster the will to make yourself think that chilling thought and do something about the approaching time when it will happen, you will find out and your children will learn the ancient meaning of the yellow peril, the colored peril. The Jews have gathered up the colored peoples of the earth, armed them with the ultimate weapons of atomic energy, and agitated them to unlimited dreams of world conquest. As I write, our experts keep expressing more and more surprise at the speed with which Red China is progressing with a deliverable H-bomb. Only a fool could fail to see that the world is rapidly approaching a terrible climax in which the most historic decision in all human history will be made, the long-awaited Armageddon or Ragnarok. And nuclear fears and threats were a big, big, big deal in the 50s and 60s in the post-war period. Lots of movies made about it. Every year, every month, every week, and every hour, we get closer to that terrible moment when Red China, allied with Black Africa, India, Black America, and the rest of the colored world, will have the power to launch at the white nations of the world rockets with H-bomb warheads. China already is within months of being able to devastate white America and white Europe. Long past that point today, and Russia is actually ahead of us in technology. We comfort ourselves with the thought that they wouldn't dare because we would blast them right back. If they kill 100 million of us, we'll kill 200 million of them. How silly can you get? Immediately after the Reds took over China, they purposely murdered 40 million people to thin out a population far too thick to support. All the colored nations have this same overpopulation problem, as we have already shown in the first part of this book. China, India, and Africa would be blessed by the destruction of several hundred million extra hungry mouths. If these colored races launch a swarm of H-bombs at us, a possibility our experts already admit, we could stop only a few of them. Most of them would get through, wiping out such cities as Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, Detroit, Boston, Dallas, Denver, Minneapolis, Houston, St. Louis, Philadelphia, and Washington. We'd lose not only more than 100 million of our people, but all the complex machinery which supports a modern industrial society. What we would destroy in retaliation against the colored world would not be people in the American sense of the word, but swarms of illiterates, miserable, barely existing coolies, cannibals, untouchables, anti-beggars, who are worthless, an actual burden to their government. The colored leaders do not fear retaliation. It would be a help to them. Russia is realizing this more and more. There is a growing hostility and fear between Russia and China because Russia realizes that China is less a communist nation than a colored nationalistic nation. Russians are white, and the Chinamen hate and attack them as imperialists and exploiters, just as they attack us, dirty American fascists. This was the rift between Russia and China, which is much debated as to whether it was real or not. This is long now outdated as Russia and China work together as the West under the Jews called neocons attempt to and successfully foment a war to try to undermine Russia, although they lost that war. The Ukrainian-Russia war is still going on as I talk, but Russia clearly winning. Russia and China allying and even adding some of the other third world nations into the mix, India and Iran. Starting to form a new world order to fight off of the intended new world order original. What's ahead for our world in your lifetime, he wrote in the late 60s, is not a war between communism and capitalism, but a war of annihilation between the elite white minority of mankind and the swarming inferior colored majority. Communism is becoming, in fact is, a colored world mutiny against the white race. And the colored Chinese are within days or months of possessing the power to destroy all of us with our own atomic weapons, which our liberals and Jews have given to them. While Johnson, de Gaulle, Kosygin, Wilson, Kissinger, and the rest of the white ninnies, well, Kissinger at least out of them, posing as statesmen, bicker and haggle with one another, Red China, harboring and training colored world revolutionists and terrorists, is organizing on a worldwide scale too terrible and bloody for the Western mind to contemplate, a Genghis Khan horde of colored death for the white race. Now, this is a bit overstated. There were some skirmishes for control in Africa, but ultimately the Chinese chose the path of just simple, calm economic development, and that has worked pretty well. Well, they just have to wait for the white West to fall apart, and it has. But the Red Scare and the Communist Scare, well, China further evolved to where it may be communist in name, but it's not so much communist in practice. It's basically just Asian authoritarian, bent on economic development. Once these colored men of the East possess the H-bomb and the ability to deliver it, nothing can stop the attack and the destruction of the West. They have everything to gain, and we have everything to lose. He was just flat wrong about this. They openly write about it, talk about it, and gloat about it, and still our statesmen play medieval games of economic sanctions, power balances, disarmament, ad nauseum. As long as the vast masses of the white men in all nations tolerate puppets and damn fools in positions of leadership, these puppets and liberals will play their childish games of 19th century power politics while the colored world and the Jews prepare for the racial Armageddon, using the white man's H weapons to destroy him. In fact, they would. Juan Raspail would write, or Daraspail would write, they would use immigration more than anything else. Lies about diversity, ideology, Christianity. To survive, we must get these puppets and fools out of positions of power and influence and install some tough, realistic leaders who will unite and organize us for survival. Such men will realize and make use of the basic fact of life that is so thoroughly forgotten by the fatheads in power today. The central fact that is being forgotten in today's insane world is force. Now here he's more or less echoing the protocols of Zion. Liberalism and intellectualism have so blinded Western man that the majority of us have forgotten the absolute and total primacy of force. Every grand of sane on every beach in the world today is where it is because of a force that put it there. When superior force meets weaker force, superior force always conquers and annihilates the weaker. The liberals and mushheads wish it were otherwise, and today's artificial world of machinery makes it appear possible to them that force can be replaced by reason. But this is as irrational and superstitious a bit of jungle thought as that of any witch doctor waving a lizard's tail over a cannibal with a broken leg. If good men abandon and denigrate force, then bad men will take it up and beat us to death with it. When good men lay down their club, bad men will smash them with that club sooner or later. If I can get over only one single point in this book, let it be this fact, that civilization, peace, and order depend not on goodwill, but force, policemen, armies, and weapons. Hitler put it more succinctly and poetically than I could hope to. Quote, the gentle goddess of peace can walk safely only at the side of the fierce god of war. Those who truly want to see a world of real order and peace, a world where men can live their lives with reasonable expectations of planning their futures and achieving goals without being shot, bombed, blown up, raped, burned, beaten to death in insurrections, eaten in the Congo, sent off to insane wars to die by millions for nothing, and forever kept in spiritual turmoil and misery, must decide right now to work for the establishment of white unity and white mastery of the world. There is no other alternative than white mastery of the world. Only the white race, always the white race, has demonstrated, over the centuries, the ability to enforce peace and order in this world. Ever since the British Empire abdicated, exactly as Adolf Hitler predicted, the world has plunged deeper and deeper into chaos, bloodshed, and terror. Nothing can stop this continuing plunge outside of an all-out drive by white men to quit arguing about petty, relatively minor differences among them, unite as a master race, and enforce peace and order. The whole world is in a state of riot, much like that in our cities. The only way to restore order in a riot is with force, instant, sure, and dramatic force, applied with intelligence and as much justice as possible, but above all, force. That word force has been made a dirty word today by the Jews and their suckers who dream of peace through wormy weakness. What used to be called our War Department, for instance, has been renamed the Defense Department, a subtle and apparently minor change, but a psychological retreat of enormous significance. The psychology of retreat and defense has robbed us of nature's primary gift to all her creatures, the will to fight, to live, and protect one's own. The whole white race has been poisoned with this subtle defeatism and weakness. The white race was once the policeman of the world, and the world was orderly. Compared to the bloody upheavals of today, it was also relatively peaceful. Unless the white race can find the leadership, the wisdom, and the will once again to police the world, the planet will continue in the grip of increasing chaos and terror until the jungle reclaims the survivors hiding in caves and holes like frightened beasts. Only a united white race, supremely conscious of its natural destiny, a destiny bequeathed it in the gift of superior birth, as a master race, a noble race able to create the wonders of Western culture, only such a united race can muster the will and strength to restore order in a world in the process of suicide and disintegration. And yet, faced by the most hideous threat of all times, outnumbered 10-1, we find ourselves disorganized, demoralized, wallowing in defeatism, crawling at the feet of our own destroyers, and losing strength every moment. It is easy to fall prey to despair. But there is another element in this cosmic crap game which must be taken into account if we are to make a correct judgment about the survival of our people and culture, is the fact of the Jewish, Negroid, Mongoloid threat. That element is timing, or if you will, destiny. The mighty white race is brainwashed, filled with suicidal self-hatred, crazy about its deadly enemies, trivialized, doped up on drugs and lies, and apparently rushing headlong toward oblivion. But the strength of the blood is still there, as we have shown in every war where the Jews have turned us loose. Whenever, as in World War II, the Jews wish us to be our ancient, ferocious, mighty selves, able to smash anything in our way, whenever they allow natural law to return to us, even in a temporary and wrong way, our people show themselves still heroes and fighters, not decadent weaklings or in any way like the people of a dying culture. The rumors of our death, to quote Mark Twain, are greatly exaggerated. They are appearances only. Let only a strong leader appear. Let our people once see the real nature of their Jewish and colored friends, as is already beginning to happen, and the blood of our Viking ancestors will well up in a berserker rage, which will sweep away the miasma of Jewish and colored poison gas from our lives as a lion sends a pack of vultures flapping with one lunge. It is not yet our time to die. Destiny has a way of doing her will in spite of all human efforts to foil her, both when she is cresting, creating, and when she is destroying. Destiny brought forth the greatness of Rome when it was time. Arid when it was time, she cast it aside and made way for the mightier barbarians, sweeping down from the cool northern forests. Destiny brought forth the British Empire when it was time, and after centuries of rule, destiny withdrew her blessing and the British Empire died when it was time. Destiny is, even now in America, conceiving the new imperium of our time. Remember the title of the chapter, White Imperium. Destiny is even now in America conceiving the new imperium of our time, the White Imperium, the unification of the white race and its conscious racial mastery of the globe. In spite of all signs of death and disease, deep within the vitals of our race is growing the embryo of that unity and that white imperium which will last for its thousands of years, and destroy all which stands in its way. Destiny simply will not be thwarted or swindled, even by such master swindlers as the Jews. The Jews have let the colored genie out of the bottle, armed him, agitated him, directed him to sick the white world, and set him galloping on a mission that the Jew hopes will turn the world over to the chosen ones. But the latest moves of the African and Asian hordes remind me of that dramatic paragraph, one of the most dramatic of all English literature, written by Somerset Maugham, which conveys my meaning as no other exposition could. Death speaks. There was a merchant in Baghdad who sent his servant to market to buy provisions, and in a little while the servant came back, white and trembling, and said, "Master, just now when I was in the marketplace, I was jostled by a woman in the crowd. When I turned, I saw it was death that jostled me. She looked at me and made a threatening gesture. Now, lend me your horse and I will ride away from this city and avoid my fate. I will go to Samarra and there death will not find me." The merchant lent him his horse and he dug his spurs into its flanks, and as fast as the horse could gallop, he went. Then the merchant went down to the marketplace and he saw me standing in the crowd and came to me and said, "Why did you make a threatening gesture to my servant when you saw him this morning?" "That was not a threatening gesture," I said. "It was only a start of surprise. I was astonished to see him in Baghdad, for I had an appointment with him tonight in Samarra." Today, the colored Unner mention of the world, the scum, the beggars, cannibals, untouchables, and all that sorry swarm let loose by the Jews are riding hard upon their horses, charging at full speed, spurring their mounts to furious gallops, racing faster and faster to Samarra. And that's how we end chapter 13, White Imperium. So whites are hard beset, but the embryo of White Imperium is growing, and whites must accept their destiny to master the globe, overcome petty divisions, unify, protect themselves, and be what they're meant to be. I've been Alex Linder reading to you chapter 13 of George Lincoln Rockwell's White Power. Thanks for being with me today. You can find everything we permanently archive at vnnforum.com, and I'll be back with you again for more from George Lincoln Rockwell's White Power real soon.